I suppose I should start this way, that I'm talking with John Gagan. He is a bass player, engineer, producer, studio owner, and all around human being. I've known for, what is it now, 30 something years, 31, 32 years, something like that.
Yes, about 32.
And I wanted to ask you a few questions. The first one is just to a basic question. What's your musical education? Because it's so different for every musician.
Primarily self-taught. I had a few key, like, individual lessons with teachers over the years. But yeah, I didn't go to a music school or a conservatory. Got a lot out of the Hummingbird Music Camp here in New Mexico. It was a week-long intensives. They used to offer a jazz week up there. And I went 2 years in a row. And it's, yeah, you just play all day, every day for a week, and you have, you know, clinicians teaching you, and you have to play in these ensembles and do a concert at the end of the week. And that was, yeah, that was very valuable for me.
Right. So that's also how you learned how to play jazz, which is a pretty complicated or complex type of music.
Yeah, I got some fundamentals there, and from one private teacher that I had a few lessons with when I first moved to Santa Fe from rural New Mexico.
Right. Do you encounter these days a lot of self-taught musicians at all, or is that becoming a rare breed?
I would say the latter, yeah. It's more and more people are going to college for it. It's sort of the modern paradigm is to get the skill set.
Do you think that is partly why jazz has changed so much since the 50s?
I think so, and I think it's changed since the 50s, and I think it's also changed a lot since the 70s. When I think we've talked about this before, the spirit of invention was still very much alive until right around the early 80s. And then the sort of young lions of jazz era sort of came in, and everything became like a historical nod.
Right. What do you think was the reason for that? The young lions, where did they come from?
Well, I think Wynton Marsalis is the poster child. He's from New Orleans.
Right.
And a lot of the people in his band were from New Orleans. And I think they were guys that really respected tradition. Wynton Marsalis's dad, who just died from COVID, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Wow. Well, he was, I think, almost 90 or in his early 90s, but... Yeah, that's pretty sad. But, you know, he was a great musician and an educator. So I think for the Marsalis brothers, they got a lot of tradition while they were developing and became very accomplished. And when Wynton first got his record deals, he was kind of a little bit more a guy of his time. But as time went on, his records became real retro. And I think his sales went up. So that sort of drove the industry towards real traditional guys wearing suits again,
right,
swinging hard. And it wasn't like the 70s where people were, you know, using distorted guitar on jazz and closed mic drums and combining it with synthesizers. And
So the adventurous spirit was sort of gone. Was that because people were getting overeducated?
Well, I think once that took hold, where it was all about, jazz became all about staying very idiomatic, it made sense to just go to school and get the skill set.
Right.
Rather than
complex, right.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, with our generation, it was more about, yeah, you wanted to play with good rhythm and you wanted to play in tune, but the third prong of that, which was just as important, in our crowd was being inventive.
Right.
And I always kind of figured, well, if you're not doing that, you're failing and why bother?
Right.
But that sort of became less important of a priority to being really versed in the idiom later right. as the 80s went on. And now you have a zillion guys that can play great, that have come out of the conservatory system and then done time in the Marcellus bands and so on. But it's, you know, it's just, to me, sounds like a rehashed late 50s stuff, which is still some of my favorite music.
Right. Do you think it's as creative, or is it more become like, let's say, classical music?
Yeah, I think that's a good parallel. It's more like classical music, where there's a language and a vocabulary that you learn.
Right.
And a repertoire.
So the musicianship, you would say, is really high, but maybe the inventiveness of the 70s and 60s is maybe not as much there.
Not as much, no.
So that's really a thing that every musician sort of should look into. Where do I find that balance? I'm crazy about the concept of balance these days, and just how do you balance these things out? So how do you think you can either teach or practice or gain that sort of creative spirit?
Well, I keep hoping that, you know, the next Thelonious Monk or even the next Charlie Hayden will come out of the woodwork, and who is not by any measure the most skilled technical player, but just has something so compelling to say that he starts working and performing all the time, and that steers it in. Because maybe people are getting bored with this excellent, 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 you know.
Right.
It does have a little bit of a generic quality of it to it. Part of one of the qualities of it is that it's so good.
Right. But that sort of takes me back to, remember when we saw Paco de Lucía in Colombia in 1994?
Yeah.
And I thought it was amazing. And the guy from the record company that was there was saying, well, I've heard him play this, you know, at this place, like 5 or 6 times. And, you know, it wasn't as good as then. In other words, he was playing the exact same thing. Isn't that part of the danger when you're playing pieces that are complex and you're not counting on your creativity or improvisation? Then your performance at best can be as good as the last performance.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like bowling where you... The perfect score is 300 and you can only go down from there.
Right. So they're all like 295, 296. Yeah.
So that's not all that inspiring, is it? Where you get the pinnacle of your execution on a certain piece. And then if you're expected to keep doing that in concert, wow, that's hard. Which is what, you know, concert violinists and concert pianists, that's their career.
Right. I've always looked at it more as like, you know, I won't be able to at some point play the pieces that I played when I was younger, and therefore the pieces should change, and hopefully I can imbue less notes with more meaning, and so you get less notes with more meaning rather than more notes with less meaning, but you're getting sort of you're delivering something.
Yeah, so you sort of took a page out of the Miles book.
I think, yeah.
He didn't want to keep his bebop thing honed.
Right.
He realized that's, you know, that's what they, what is it called, the Red Queen's race, where you have to run faster and faster to stay in the same spot.
Right. What is it called, the Red Queen's race? Red
Queen's race, yeah. I think it's from Alice in Wonderland.
I don't understand. I wanted to ask you... your brothers are both guitar players. You became a bass player. Do you think your personality lent itself to bass? I know you kind of were shoved into playing bass, but Could you see yourself in a different situation as a piano player or a guitar player? Or was bass really the best option for you?
Hard to say. Like you said, I
Right.
did get drafted because they had their garage band and
Right.
needed a bass player. And I was at the age, I was 13, where it was nice to, be the only bass player
Right.
that spot that I occupied.
Right.
And
I think what I'm asking is that I think there is these two things are happening. One is the instrument changes your personality, and also you choose your instrument because of your personality, which is probably a starting point. And then the instrument sort of makes you change, right?
Right.
Do you see those two streams happening?
I do. Yeah. Or you'd say somebody that wants to maybe be the lead guitar player, they gravitate towards that because they have a certain kind of personality. And then
Shitty personality.
when
A shitty personality, right?
Well, yeah.
Whatever I see on a record, on a cover, lead guitarist and rhythm guitarist, I don't need to listen to it. It's just
Right.
so stupid.
Guitarist is good, is fine.
Right.
But yeah, then you're saying once a certain kind of person wants the limelight or whatever,
Right.
and then they start playing a certain instrument, and then that just kind of starts a feedback loop of them becoming more a certain way, or a bass player that wants to blend in or be part of a team.
Right.
Yeah, I think those things are at work.
If you had a choice of careers, would it be Pino Palladino or would it be Christian McBride?
Oh, I would say Pino Palladino. Yeah, I think he's had a great career. When he first came on the scene, his sound was instantly recognizable,
Right.
phenomenal. And then he seemed to understand that sound would become dated, so he pivoted, I guess is the right word. And now he can still do that fretless thing that you would hear on the old Paul Young records and the stuff he did with Elton John and Don Henley. But now he's more known for playing with D'Angelo and John Mayer and Eric Clapton and anybody who needs just a great rhythm section guy.
Right.
He's kind of he's become the
The question was also like, one is a jazz career, one is more of an R&B pop career. Which one appeals to you now, after everything we've said about what jazz has become, you know?
Right. Yeah, I would stick with the career as a session player playing different styles.
Right.
I'm sure, if you're a concert artist in the jazz realm, it's got to be a good life. You're getting paid to play concerts, and that's the tip of a very sharp pyramid. There are a lot of people doing it, and the people that can actually make a living doing it, and a good living, is, tiny. You get to do your thing every night and be creative. But it's, yeah, I guess for me, my interests are a little more diverse, and I like the chance to get into different things, and also not be one of the things that's been so great about playing with you all these years is it's, I guess we sort of defined our own parameters.
Right.
We're not, there's not a fence around us. Like, oh, that's not jazz. You can't do that. That's not funk. You can't do that. So yeah, we do whatever we want. So that's a dream.
Right. Yeah, that is always a nightmare, isn't it? That sort of thing. I remember playing a Solea for what's his face in '94, that guy that played with us for a couple of shows, and he would point out, you can't do that, you know, you're switching keys.
Oh,
That's
yeah.
not a Solea anymore. It's like, wow, who wants that sort of straitjacket, right?
Yeah. Did you get like a citation in the mail that you had to pay $55 for that chord?
I wonder whether, you know, I've been to flamenco forums when that was still a thing in the mid 90s. Have you ever been to bass forums? Are they similar where it's like, well, this is what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, those things. It's like the comments on YouTube or a forum. I think it's people that spend more time on forums than they do practicing or playing gigs, so I'm not too interested in what they have to say.
Do you feel like let me preface this with, ever since about 1990, I thought you'd be like one phone call away from touring with really famous people and getting the Pino Palladino type
Well,
of
I have been touring famous people.
projects. No, I meant like, the Pino, that you get all these calls from people. Do you sometimes feel like you missed out on something? Because I know you're happy with what you're doing now. You like having a home base and spending, a good amount of time there rather than being out on tour all the time. Some of those tours that Pino goes on, man, those things are rough, 3, 4 months, sometimes longer.
Yeah.
Do you sometimes wonder what it would have been like, or does it not even ever register with you? Like, I wish I had had that.
Well, I wonder, but it's never with a sense of regret, you know. I feel like I'm one of the lucky ones where I was able to happen into a playing situation of making albums on touring, doing music that was created by us rather than having to, play somebody else's parts off of a record or so I think, if I had moved to a bigger city when I was in my early 20s, yeah, who knows, I might have ended up doing some more kind of generic sidemen stuff, which would have been rewarding but not as rewarding. And so it's more a wondering. There's no real regret about it. I feel like I'm really one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, I feel like more things could have happened for us if I or we had moved to Los Angeles, but at the same time, I can't imagine what it would have been like, and I probably would have become an asshole, I think.
Yeah.
It's just one of those cities, the temptation of all these things, and it's just such a different lifestyle than here that, I've thought about it. Maybe I would have liked to get into soundtracks and do other things, but the cost probably would have been too high, I
Yeah,
imagine.
I agree. I wouldn't have wanted to have lived there, even though there would have been probably a big upside, hopefully with soundtracks. And we had a few close calls, which seemed to not pan out, maybe partially because we were here. We weren't part of the one hand washing another network and the network. Cool. Also, I was going to say, the music is, it's a New Mexico product, which is cool. That's one of the things that makes it unique.
I think that it is an expression of the Santa Fe of a New Mexico music scene, which does take from so many other places, So it does allow you to be more like, well, it's whatever we want to do, and there is such a spirit of experimentation here anyway that it just makes more sense than trying to move this to some other city and hope that it can remain the same.
Yeah, and when we were in California, what, we did 4 albums out there. It was just sort of, you were just ignoring everything that the label was occasionally throwing at us anyway, so.
Yeah, that would have been worse because they would have come by more often, that's for sure.
Right.
That's for sure. Well, I wanted to ask about your own music. What does it start with? Does it start with a rhythm? Does it start with a bass line? Does it start with some chord changes, all of the above, or
Yeah, it's the the genesis of it can come from maybe I'm playing bass and I start to play something that sounds like a song, or maybe I'll be fooling around with a synth patch and that suggests something.
Right.
So yeah, stuff like that, or playing piano, that's a good way to start develop a song.
Right.
Because you can do the chords and the melody together, which is a little trickier on bass.
Right. Do you think the cooking metaphor is very apt for what we do?
How do you mean that exactly?
Well, it just seems like, you know, making music to me is a lot. Like people always say, you know, when people ask about creativity, I always have to say that it's either something you have or you don't. And I don't know a single musician that doesn't cook. You know, they may not all cook well, but, you know, they cook. It's just, you know, you heard all these stories about Miles making food and then calling people to come over and have some whatever he was making. And it just seems like cooking is a really good metaphor for cooking up some music, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that tracks well, because you want it to taste good at the end. This should be the objective, rather than have somebody say, wow, it's amazing what he did with salt.
Right.
It doesn't taste good. It's not really that interesting.
Right. Well, is there... How does the creativity happen for you? Is it a place that you visit? Is it a thing that just is a tap that you can turn on sometimes? Is it on all the time? Is it sometimes not there? How does it feel for you?
I feel like it's kind of always there, sometimes to the point of distraction. Where I'll, you know, I'll kind of need to get something done. But then I start to get on an idea. I just want to follow it. And
yeah.
One of life's challenges to balance all that out.
Right.
So yeah, I don't never seem to be that far away from ideas coming out.
Right. Do you notice that some weeks are better for it than others?
I've never really kind of tried to, you know, follow that per se, but I suppose so. Yeah.
Yeah. I've only done it because it gets so frustrating, because there's days when I know it's not there. And I remember you were telling me one time this, the story about Frank Sinatra arriving at a full studio ready with like what, 60, whatever more musicians and engineers and everything. And did he even try a song?
I think for the first few days he would just try a half a song and he knew it wasn't going to be the day. And
boy, so, I'm going home.
Yeah. Great defense, call it a day. And
yeah. And I feel like there is days like that. And I'm happy to like do editing or work on other things that are, you know, simple things, even like, today I'll change my strings because I know I'm not going to be good at playing.
Yeah.
You know, but it just feels like certain weeks or days are just very different from others. And, you know, if you're working for somebody else, then you have to run against the wall until you get something. Yeah. But when you're working for yourself, I've discovered that it's easier and healthier to just call it a day like Frank did, you know? Do you feel the same way, or do you feel like, you know, I'm not going to let that stop me? I'm just going to like.
Well, I think, you know, if I'm doing a session for somebody else, like you said, I have to get to something that's usable.
Right.
But if I'm doing my own stuff, there are days where I'll start in earnest and realize that I'm not getting anywhere. So I'll call it a day and do something else. But it also creates a kind of pressure, like when you are feeling it, like you sort of have one failed attempt lurking in the background. And so that usually kind of goes away once you start in, once you pick up that same song again or whatever.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely something to the idea of flow, because I know there's days when I go into the studio and I work and it's just, everything you do just seems to sort of fit and make sense and work. And there's other days where absolutely nothing does.
Right.
And I
Yeah.
can't quantify it. I can't really explain it.
Yeah. Could be some, they used to call them biorhythms, right?
Yeah.
With tennis players in the 70s and
Yep.
80s.
Yep. If somebody, I usually hate these questions like lists, but what are some of your the records that you've heard that really made you look twice, listen twice, listen a whole bunch of times, maybe change your head about what you wanted to achieve with your own music?
Yeah, that's probably a pretty long list. I think once I started playing, the artist that really grabbed me, and this kind of goes back to the question of being a trained musician or not. The first two that really grabbed me were Jeff Beck and Jaco Pastorius. And neither of those guys went to school for music, so they were a little bit of a beacon, and I was 13. I was willing to set aside the fact that those guys are both straight up geniuses, and just inspired by them. But yeah, they both kind of invented their own sound and approach to music and approach to the instruments they play, and did it beautifully. And that was just so inspiring to me. So, like, Jaco's first album and Heavy Weather and the songs that he played on Black Market, Bright Size Life with Pat Metheny. In the mid-70s, he was, he really came in hot. His game was really, really honed. And so that stands up as some of his best playing. So I was all over that. And Jeff Beck, Blow by Blow, was an album. Just blew my mind. I still love it. And well, some of the other stuff that Jeff Beck has done, Emotion and Commotion, he did about 10 years ago. Phenomenal. He just so dialed in at what his thing is, sort of a almost vocal level and beyond of expression on guitar. And just nobody can is really doing what he, nobody's even attempting what he does in a lot of
They're
ways.
like, I don't want to be compared to that. I don't even want to get close. I'm like, white flag, white flag. Yeah.
But, and
It's
there are some
amazing
jazz
you could.
albums.
Which
I was
one?
thinking, like Kenny Wheeler, New High, that was real formative for me.
ECM, right?
Yeah, there was an album that came out in 1981. Chicoria Three Quartets with Eddie Gomez. That was a real, I listened to that a lot. That was with Michael Brecker and Steve Gadd. And it's jazz, but it's funny because it has that early 80s sound with the, sort of a pickup on the upright bass, and Eddie Gomez sort of real snarly sound. And it's a strange sound, but it's hard to imagine that particular music that Chick Corea wrote without that bass sound. So, yeah, they did an album for its time, and might not be my favorite album now, but when it came out, it really caught my ear. And
It's like a drum machine and reverb and 16th notes for the 80s, right? It's like it's almost like if you don't do it, you're not part of that time to begin with.
Which I said, say what you want about the 80s and it being a lot of regrettable style choices in music and on TV and in clothes, but at least people were trying. At least you can tell something's from the 80s. If you hear a jazz record that was recorded between maybe 1986 and now, you wouldn't be able to tell when it was recorded. Necessarily. It's like, wow, that sounds great. Everything's in place. Okay, good.
So,
That's part of what's missing.
right. It seems that maybe we're losing something in dismissing self-taught as an option, you know?
I think so.
Yeah.
It's add to that the fact that the college degree from a conservatory is so expensive. The joke I have is you got to believe in reincarnation to think that that's a good investment. And yeah, if you're going to spend, hundreds of thousands of dollars getting a degree playing jazz, that's you're not going to be able to bill like a lawyer bills. You're just going to go join the ever-expanding workforce of skilled working jazz musicians.
Well, with some of the stuff we're finding out about DNA and that you're actually inheriting some of the sorrows and whatever horrible things or great things that happened to even your great great grandparents, then maybe if you spend that money and it takes all of your life to pay it back, but maybe your great grandson, if you have one, or granddaughter
Oh,
will.
yeah.
Will have a career because they'll come out of the gate and people will go, oh my God, where does all this talent come from?
Yeah.
They don't know that 4 generations previous, some poor schmuck paid $250,000 to Berklee College of Music for a
Right.
degree.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to take a longer view.
Yeah, I definitely miss. I think the thing I miss most about digital music is to look at any sort of cover, that sort of experience of opening an LP or, looking at a big cover of an LP or opening a CD booklet and going through. The covers, most covers are just, even digital, they're not the same. They don't go for the same thing anymore.
Yeah, isn't that weird? And I guess we'll never go back to music actually being feeling like a physical product. It's just some stuff that's on your computer and you can skip to the next song at your absolute whim, and it's a loss.
How many times have you bought a record and you hated a song on it? And has it ever happened to you that eventually you liked it or even loved it?
Oh yeah, many times. You might even dislike it a little bit the first time,
Right.
and then after a while it's your favorite one.
Right, so it would stand to reason if you would have been able to skip it, you would have skipped it.
Without skip it without getting up and moving the
Exactly. So maybe that physical thing of like, I have to get up and lift that tone arm and put it over to the next track, that's too much trouble. I'll rather listen to the 4 minutes or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So that's an experience of learning something that just is not very likely to ever happen again, right?
No. And the same thing, I think we've talked this about this before, where if you, when you're a teenager and you have to save up, back then it was what, $4 to buy an album or something, which is cheap compared to even the way CDs were priced, but it was a lot of money for, a 14-year-old guy in the
Sure,
70s. And
sure.
so you save up your money, you go buy that album, it's gonna have value to you, and you're gonna really investigate to see if you like it, as opposed to, somebody giving you a thumb drive
Right.
with 15 albums on it. You're probably not even gonna have time to even listen to all of it once. And you haven't paid a cent for it, so it's kind of literally worthless to you.
So the emotional investment, I remember buying shitty albums and listening to them many times to figure out that, maybe it was me, maybe it was great, and I want to like this because I paid money for it. And in some cases, I got something out of it. In some cases, it was obviously futile, but there was this sort of emotional, I bought into this. I have to get something out of it.
Yeah, I did that too.
Right.
Maybe you also learn. You kind of distill the things that you really don't like. Like, oh, I I hate it to use that, having the piano come in on the second verse every time. That bugs me, or whatever, you know. You start to get your taste defined by some of the negative parameters too.
At least they were actually playing the piano on every chorus. Now it's just copy and paste, right?
Think of what they used to have to go through with background vocals, so they get these singers to do it perfectly over and over again.
Did you ever buy an album because you like the cover?
I wonder. I don't recall that I did. Did you?
Yeah, multiple times. And sometimes it was shite, and sometimes it was good.
Can you
I
think of?
do miss. I remember Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard, and I would go in maybe twice a year, maybe a little more, but about that, whenever we were in LA and had a few days, and I'd go in, and sometimes one of the people working would recognize me and give me a list of, this is, oh, have you heard this? Have you heard this? And I'd just buy everything they suggested, and more often than not, like 8 out of 10 were like amazing records that I'd never heard of.
Yeah, that's good percentage.
And I it's like now I guess you can find websites that do the same thing, but there's just something that's not the same, I guess. It's not the same. It's not the same. And it exactly like when I read, if I were to read an article about a wine and then I mail order it, that's not the same thing as going to a wine store, looking around, finding somebody, and they recommend the thing that you're looking for. It's, maybe that just shows my age, but it just seems like it's not the same thing as going to a record store and looking through the stuff and maybe talking to the
Oh,
staff.
right. Yeah, I probably did that, where I'd be leafing through the shelves and see a cover combined with recognizing the name of the artist and going, wow, this looks really compelling. Can you buy it? And yeah, maybe it's really good.
What type of music are you listening to like this month? Did you have something that you're obsessed with?
Not currently. When the shutdown first started, for some reason I was listening to Burt Bacharach music all the time.
That's great.
It was scratching an itch for me, and yeah, there's a lot there to really get interested in, and hearing how different singers interpret it, and getting your absolute favorites, and oh, that person, I hate the way they sing Burt Bacharach, and
You've got a playlist of the best Burt Bacharach. John Gagan's playlist of Burt Bacharach. That would be
so I
great.
could have weigh in on my own opinions of, the quintessential version of this song is done by this singer, and so on.
You have a real knack for diving into things, right? Because I remember we were on tour one time, and there was a piece of music. It was a classical piece of music, and I forget what that style is called. It was very sad. It was a prayer-like thing. And I think for like weeks, you listen to it every day.
Oh yeah, it was probably Fauré's Requiem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I
Yes.
think it was almost a year.
Wow.
Yeah, when we were touring and out on the bus with headphones, I would do that at the end of the day, and it just seemed to be a good touchstone for me.
Right. That seems like a bass player thing to do, though, isn't it?
Possibly, yeah.
This sort of, if the bass is not just right there, and that sort of concentration, that sort of depth seems like a pretty natural fit. I don't think I've made it for a year, but I do get obsessed with different types of music at different times.
You play the same record over and over.
Yeah, just because there's something in there that I want to catch. What is it? What makes it so compelling? What is it about it? Or just to understand. I remember certain records, listening to them and going, wow, this is really good, but I'm actually often I was amazed at how loose it was, how the rhythm was just sort of there. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't the super tight thing. It was just this sort of thing, almost like a gossamer thing that you think if one of them had just strayed by the tiniest fraction, the whole thing would have collapsed.
Yeah.
And those are fun to study. It's like, okay, what actually holds this together? Is there anything?
Right.
Or did they just get high together and it worked, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a nice contrast to music that's over-quantized and doesn't have a, you know, it's mathematically perfect. It becomes boring.
Right.
So you get something that sounds like, what's even making this work in the first place? That's right. Very cool.
I agree. What would your advice if somebody said, you know, say your nephew wants to become a musician, what would you tell him?
That's a good
question. Get a real job.
Right. Well, yeah, I guess you'd want to gauge the level of obsession, you know, so mm-hmm. If you can't imagine yourself doing anything else, then I guess the question's already been answered.
Right.
But if you think you're doing it because you want to be on TV and make a lot of money, maybe that's even harder to do back when we were starting out, which was, you know, almost impossible back then.
Right.
Lightning had to strike and you had to have your act together, mm. both.
Right.
And now with people don't buy records and, I don't you really even understand what's driving the industry at this point. Downloads? Who's making money off of that?
I think they're saying more and more it's actually money from streaming, but you know, that's one of those things. Yeah, there will be 0.1 or 0.005% that will be, you know, at the top, and they'll get enough streams, and we're looking at what, I don't know, you know, billions of streams in order to get a fat check.
Yeah,
you know, everybody underneath that really get nothing.
And do you think that the element of needing to be some sort of a huge personality in order to get to that level, do you think that's bigger than ever? Or is it enough to just sing great and write good songs?
It doesn't seem like it. I mean, look at politics. We're not looking for people that are competent at politics. We're looking at, you know, big personalities. And I think maybe a similar thing is happening. You know, maybe it's a cultural thing of the moment where if you're going to be some sort of star, whether that's political or as an actor, there's got to be something else there. You can't just be competent. It has to be, hopefully you'll have a little bit of competence, but a lot of it just seems to be like this thing. And doesn't it seem like most of those names keep switching faster than ever? You know,
right. We're down blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. You know, the 15 minutes of fame have turned into like 15 seconds or something.
It's true.
But let's say your nephew says, you know, I absolutely, this is the only thing I want to do. Nothing else matters. And I don't care how much money I make. This is what I want to do. What would you tell him?
I tell him, you know, if you really want to be fulfilled by it, find your voice. Because it just seems, if they would be asking my view of it, that to become, you know, a really good Stevie Ray Vaughan imitator, or to be able to sing like Robert Plant or something like that, and be in a band doing Led Zeppelin covers, that's not what I was ever into it for.
Mm.
And so I would give him that feedback and say, you know, finding your own voice is a big part of what makes it fulfilling.
Right.
And it makes, if you get onto it, it makes you want to practice. It makes you want to keep getting closer to what what you feel you're capable of.
Mm.
And that can fuel you into your old age.
Right. That's definitely a very 70s sort of look at things, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Nowadays, people would say, well, you've got to play like all these different guitar players so you're more likely to get a job.
Yeah. And if you look at bass, it seems to me that people can be almost kind of offended if the bass is anything other than really ancillary to the rest of the stuff.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, you know, stay in your lane and stay blended in with the guitars and the rest of it. You know, we're not interested in the Jaco thing or, you know, ostentatious bass playing.
Mm.
So yeah, like in the Americana movement, it's just mostly upright bass that just serves a really ancillary function.
Mm.
In there. And it's, you know, it's not easy to do well. Nothing is easy to do well, but
you're interchangeable.
Things that feature bass, if we're talking about bass, are really out of fashion right now. And I don't know if it'll ever come back.
Wow.
In terms of, you know, music that has vocals on it.
Yeah, well, that loops back to Pino Palladino on that one song, Tear Your Playhouse Down.
Yeah.
He's like the second vocalist.
Yeah, and that song was on the radio.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I believe in pendulum swings, and I think the bass players that stood out, and we could probably easily name, you know, 10 or so, you know, they brought a lot of life and joy to those songs. It's got to come back.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like I've always rather wanted to play something that I feel is mine than something infinitely more complex that isn't mine.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I just, like you said, I would get more out of developing a voice. And I think maybe it's because that's harder to teach or impossible to teach, that the colleges that now teach music, I mean, how do you teach getting your own voice?
Yeah, I don't think they even address that.
Right.
They want to get the tuition and turn out people that are competent. And
right.
You can do that by getting, you know, a long checklist of skills.
Mm.
And that gets longer all the time. The new generation is so good at playing in odd meters. It makes the adventurous stuff from the 70s, like Jan Hammer and all that, makes it sound pretty mathematical, you know. But that's... not that many listeners care about odd meters, you know.
I think odd meters are a lot more fun when you don't notice them.
Yeah, which was one of the cool things about some of the Jan Hammer stuff.
Right. Yeah. You know, when we've used 7/4 or 5/4 or whatever, you know, people just never even noticed it, which I thought was really the point.
Right.
I know.
Just how many beats the music needs. No more, no less.
That's it. That's it. I think that's a perfect way to end this. Thanks for the conversation, man. That was good.
Yeah, thank you too. Thanks for inviting me. It was fun.
All right. Thanks, man. Bye.